Hey, teacher, is this stuff going to be on the test? Pretty common question in most schools, is it not? This morning we're going to take a look at the question of evaluation of testing and grading as we study the fifth and final point in our essential structures, essential elements within our five-level structure in Christian education. If you have a study sheet, this is on the material that we'll be following is on page 9. The educational journals, a lot of the books on education that have come out in recent years, have had a school of thought that's been against traditional forms of testing and grading. When I use the expression traditional forms of testing and grading, I'm referring to, as far as tests are concerned, a regular, every 3 weeks, every 4 weeks, every midterm, every at the end of every term, whatever, a standard test, the kind of things that we think of when we hear the word test, be it fill in the blank, be it question and answer, be it essay, be it whatever. And when I say traditional grading, I obviously mean the report card with the various subjects on it, history, geography, spelling, mathematics, etc., with either A, B, C, D, F, or 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, with 1 standing for outstanding and 5 standing for failing, or something along those lines. A lot of the educational journals have come out over the past decade questioning that concept, these concepts of testing and grading. The objections are occasionally quite relevant, and we'll talk about some of those relevant objections. Most of the time, however, in your non-Christian educational journals, there are objections which are either rather ludicrous or spring from some of the more bizarre aspects of humanistic education, which causes the adherents thereto to come up with rather odd objections to testing and grading as well as everything else. The first and foremost group, naturally, which opposes traditional forms of testing and grading is the quote-unquote schools without failure crowd. William Glasser naturally came out with a book several years ago entitled Schools Without Failure, in which, among other things, he advocated the idea that it's very dangerous to grade a child and to apply a letter grade or whatever to that child because it's going to do him psychological damage to label him as such. In other words, the basic argument is if a child is labeled a failure in mathematics, he's going to adopt that label and it's going to become a self-fulfilling prophecy. He is going to intentionally become a failure in mathematics for the purpose of living up to his label. And so labeling a child when he's in the third grade as a failure is going to follow him all the way through the 12th grade or the 16th grade or whatever education the child is going to receive. And he's going to be a failure all the way through because that's the label that's been imposed upon him. Mr. Glasser's argument, Dr. Glasser's argument basically is, even if a child is not performing well in a given discipline, do not fail him. Simply promote him. This, obviously, is also the first of our improper objections to the traditional forms of testing and grading. remarkably, that concept has gotten a pretty good following. Dr. Glasser did not articulate it quite as crudely as I just did, but I think I've given a fairly accurate description of the bottom line analysis of the situation. That obviously is an improper objection to traditional forms of testing and grading because you're asking the world to overlook the fact that the child is not producing well in a given area. Now, I think we will all grant you that, especially with young children, we do not want to hang a sign which says failure around their necks or something like that, but we're not doing the child a service by ignoring the fact that he's incompetent in a certain area. Telling someone they failed once or even many times is not necessarily a cruelty if that becomes a spur or a means of motivation to conquer that little bit of territory and to become a success in that territory. Now, the concern that the people in the Schools Without Failure movement articulate is that grading and testing and modern forms of school promotion and so on has become cold, it's become heartless, and the child is the victim. Now, to whatever extent that's true, that becomes a legitimate objection in the sense that an F on a report card should not be the be-all and end-all, or even an A on a report card should not be the be-all and end-all of the grading process, of the educational process. That failure in a certain area should prompt us to seek to better instruct Johnny or Sally in that given area. When we get further down in our lecture, we'll talk more about the importance of educating not just Johnny and Sally about in terms of the place that the grading system occupies in their education, but mom and dad too. If Johnny or Sally come home with a less than spectacular grade in a certain area, if they've been goofing off all semester, that's one thing. If there's been a legitimate effort in that area, and if the grade is too low for daddy's preferences and daddy takes them to the woodshed on that account, again, then the grading system has kind of become a cold and a heartless thing. So there's legitimate objections within the Schools Without Failure movement, but the overall reason why we have to reject it is because it never allows us to inform a person that they're not competent in a given area. And that in and of itself is not a cruelty. To inform someone that they can't do something is not to label that person a failure for the rest of their life. It is simply to indicate to them that there's more area to conquer here. There's new ground which has to be broken. There's new efforts which have to be made. And it's a challenge to us as teachers to renew a dedication, a commitment to that child, to approach the subject matter in a new manner, to try something that's perhaps going to allow that knowledge to sink into Johnny or Sally's little mind. Improper objection number two. Many educators claim a mastery of the facts, the quote-unquote cognitive domain, is unimportant, as the real goal of education is refinement of feeling and attitudes, the so-called affective domain. One of the things that people have to suffer through if they pursue a state teaching credential is nonsensical courses dealing with the physical domain, the psychomotor domain, the cognitive domain, and the affective domain, and whatever other domains people may be dreaming up somewhere along the line. The two that get the most press is naturally the cognitive domain and the affective domain. And a lot of teachers who are into these little domain businesses, may God in His grace deliver us from such, have, in a sense, argued that the cognitive domain, the domain of knowledge, the domain of factuality, is basically unimportant. Now here we see the good old humanistic philosophy rearing its ugly head again, in the sense that what is being advocated is that there's really no importance to the truth, basically because there's probably no such thing as truth. Cognitive domain concerns itself with facts, with numbers, with dates, with figures, with essays, and all that sort of gobbledygook, which implies an objective body of knowledge is bouncing around somewhere out there that we can put inside our little minds that's truth. And naturally, in humanistic education, you don't talk about truth a whole lot. You talk about values clarification. What's good for you? How do you feel about this? And so on. The people that are on this little bandwagon say that the highest goal of education is not the cognitive domain, it's the affective domain, the domain of feelings and attitudes and emotions and values and all that sort of thing. So since the cognitive domain does not occupy the highest place in the educational hierarchy, testing and grading and all that kind of stuff only really applies to the cognitive domain. You can't test your feelings, your attitudes, your emotions. You have to get those out during a rap session or something like that. So why should we emphasize a whole lot about feelings and emotions and, pardon me, about knowledge and content and so on, which is what a grade or a report card talks about, because your feelings, your attitudes are the most important thing. So I don't know how they propose going about reporting the development of your feelings, your attitudes, or whatever, but a lot of groups say, let's throw away tests and grades and report cards because we're more concerned with molding the children's attitudes, you know, giving them the proper perspective on the proper feeling about abortion and nuclear weapons and all those other things that eight-year-olds are supposed to be so knowledgeable of. Third improper objective. Some claim that the teacher's ability to give grades, give as in, I don't like you, Johnny, you get an F, forms an unacceptable barrier between student and teacher. That argument proceeds on the assumption that Johnny and Sally get grades from the teacher which are totally unrelated to their performance. We've all probably heard teachers saying, if you people don't be quiet, I'm going to lower your grade, as if behavioral problems could somehow lower academic performance on a given test or something like that. Sometimes bad teachers use the grading scale, the report cards, tests, and so on, to control an unruly class, which is really not what they're intended to do, but we'll hear the old, this is going to be on the test, and if you're talking now, I'm not going to give this information to you, but it's going to be on the test anyway. All of those things go to form this little group or movement that says that teachers should not have authority over the child. And the ability to give grades gives the teachers an unwarranted power and influence over the child. That objection, even though you see it quite often, is simply only relevant to someone who has absolutely no conception what tests and grades are supposed to do in the first place. They're using them simply as a measure of the student's personality or a means of classroom control or whatever. That's an improper use of testing and grading, so that then becomes an improper objection to testing and grading. Tests and grades, when used properly, are not going to be used as classroom control techniques, and personal evaluations of the teacher's preferences in terms of the way people part their hair and so on. Improper objection number four. Educators influenced by behaviorism claim testing and grading encourage the student to cheat. Remarkably, there's a very good book out by a very sound Christian writer who, when he's talking about testing and grading, takes this particular approach. And it's an amazing thing, because this man is more qualified in another area. Even though the book on education is very, very good, the individual is more qualified in another area, which in all of his books he attacks behaviorism with a vengeance, and he does an absolutely magnificent job of stripping the nonsensical nature of behaviorism bare. But for some strange reason, in his book on education, he's not real big on testing and grading, and right in the middle of the book he develops the idea that it almost forces children to cheat. And that amazes me, that would come out of a Christian man who is so excellent in his other given area, and who has such a better perspective on behaviorism, it seems, when he's writing in his other area than he does in the area of Christian education. Be that as it may, there is a big school of thought, especially among your non-Christian educators, that claim that that testing and grading forms a negative environmental stimulus. Isn't that a profound educational bit of terminology there? The negative stimulus to your environment, in the sense that the student can't win. There's no way that a student can adequately perform day after day, week after week, month after month, year after year, in all of these tests in which they are constantly being inundated. And so the teacher is, in a sense, forcing the child to approach the test in some way besides studying. And naturally, we're talking about cheat sheets, we're talking about looking on the person paper that sits next to you, we're talking about this, that, or the other thing. Breaking into the office at midnight and stealing the answer key, whatever. Amazingly, as I said, some Christians take this approach. I'm all against badly written tests and improper forms of testing and grading. But you can't say that even a badly written test forces a student to cheat. You simply cannot say that. That is a skirting of the entire issue of Christian responsibility and so on. Now, I feel sorry for intelligent students in a class who are being forced to take nonsensical tests. And there are a lot of nonsensical tests out there. Some teachers, especially inexperienced teachers, ask students to learn and or to memorize the most pointless list of facts and figures, or the most pointless this, that, or the other sort of thing, which is in no way, shape, or form going to contribute to their education, which is in no way, shape, or form going to become a permanent part of them. They're going to forget it 10 seconds after they take the test, even if they have to sit down and memorize it, and so on. I'm totally against that. I'm totally against asking our students to waste their time in memorizing things that are irrelevant, in doing things that boil down to nothing more than busy work, and taking tests which are not indicative of careful thought and research and analytical skill and whatnot, but are simply exercises and regurgitating on a piece of paper what the teacher wants to hear and so on. I'm against that, and I know how frustrating that can be for students, for good students, for intelligent students, to have to go through all that kind of nonsense. But a good, honest, intelligent student will put up with that nonsense and do what has to be done, even if he thinks it's ridiculous, and in many cases it is ridiculous. But a good, honest student is not going to be forced to cheat, even by a poor teacher who is not capable of constructing an intelligent test. So let's not adopt the old behavioristic idea that this forces the student to become less than what he or she really are internally, because that's simply not true. Improper objection number 5. Some claim that testing and grading discriminate against the creative student in favor of the passive student. The creative student, it is said, wants to pursue this, that, and the other sort of thing in this given area, but he can't because the teacher's got a body of knowledge upon which he's going to test the student. And it's the passive student, the student who's not going to be tremendously interested in doing outside reading and following thoughts and ideas and so on, who just sits there and copies down everything that the teacher says in class and then passively memorizes it and gives the teacher back virtually the teacher's own words on the test, whereas the creative student would rather be pursuing a thought or engaging in a discussion or going to the dictionary or the encyclopedias or the textbooks and so on and pursuing things or expanding his knowledge of this, that, or the other sort of thing. I'll grant you that that is not a totally irrelevant objection, but I will grant you that, again, that is a abuse of a legitimate form of testing and grading rather than a categorical objection to the whole concept of testing and grading. Passive students do perform better in a lot of educational settings because tests are oftentimes more easily taken by passive students than active, aggressive, creative ones. But that is simply an indication that teacher has not learned very well yet how to write a test. Because the more passive the student, the more chances are that you're going to simply, when you give a test, when you look at that, the answers that have been written up for that test, the more passive the student, the more chances you're going to see virtually the exact terminology from either the textbook or from what teacher said in class regurgitated on that piece of paper. And we've got to learn that regurgitating phraseology out of the textbook or regurgitating the teacher's favorite little hobby horses, which were written during the class and then placed back on the piece of paper here, that's not necessarily an indication of thought. That is not necessarily an indication of growth. That is not necessarily an indication of the acquisition of knowledge, lo and behold. So what we got here is a setting in which the passive student oftentimes is better served by the passive teacher, by the unimaginative teacher, by the teacher whose tests are not designed to make the students think and to evaluate whether real and true learning has taken place. A teacher that's good at writing a test, though, who can write a test that is not going to be answered by one-word answers or by one-phrase answers, but it's going to show going to produce a test that will really dig down inside the student's mind and force him to express his understanding of the given subject area or whatever, that's a teacher who's going to better serve the creative student. In other words, the student whose mind is really full of this knowledge, this body of content which is supposedly being passed on here. All right, those were 5 improper objections, in my humble opinion, to traditional forms of testing and grading. Let's talk about 9 legitimate concerns. Now, these are not necessarily objections. These are just concerns which, in our testing and grading practices, we need to constantly keep in our minds so that we can try to avoid a few of the pitfalls here. Issue number one, tests and grading tend to be subjective. They don't have to be subjective, but they tend to be more times than not. And what I mean by that, it's very difficult to grade tests. A lot of teachers do give one-word answer tests. A lot of teachers do give fill-in-the-blank or multiple choice A, B, C, D with 3 out of 4 of the answers being totally ridiculous, short sentence tests which can be answered in short sentences and so on, because the longer or the more profound, the deeper, quote-unquote, an essay-type test might be given, the more difficult it is for the teacher to grade that sort of a thing, because it borders on becoming subjective at this level here. Even something that would seem to be as straightforward as mathematics sometimes can be subjective. Sometimes, if you'll give a teacher a essay-type paper and you're on the teacher's right side, the teacher might give you a B. But if you give the teacher the exact same words written out in the handwriting of another student whom the teacher does not have a tendency to like so well, or whom the teacher in the back of his or her mind says, this is a C student, so therefore he usually produces C papers, we'll probably wind up with a C. There have been all sorts of conniving little studies done of that, and I'm not very big on educational studies, but I have to recognize my own inadequacies here, that there's some people that we have a tendency to think are going to produce good papers, and other people whom we, regrettably, as human beings, would have a tendency to think are not going to do as good a job. There have been all sorts of little studies in which Miss A student and Mr. C student will write up a paper, and then they'll exchange papers, and Miss A student will write out Mr. C student's paper in longhand, turn it in, vice versa, will be done. And the paper that would probably have been a C was in Mr. C's longhand, because it's in Miss A's longhand, will get an A or an A minus or whatever, and vice versa. So it wasn't really probably the content, it was probably more the student which influenced the teacher's mind, and so on. We're human, and there's going to be a few gray areas probably in most types of testing and grading which we are engaged in. And so in the first place, we need to be aware of that. We need to try to be as objective as possible. And we need to let parents know that. There should be a little disclaimer or whatever on report cards which says something to the effect, hey, Mom and Dad, we've done the best job we can in trying to evaluate the quality and the quantity of Johnny and Sally's learning in these areas. But we're human. And we may have made some mistakes somewhere along the line, too. We've done the best job we can. We've tried to be as accurate and as objective as we can. But take this report card with a grain of salt. If Johnny and Sally aren't quite living up to the expectations that you would have wanted for them, remember that maybe somewhere along the line we've missed some things too. So let's just use this report card as a spur to all of us to strive for greater goals rather than making this an occasion to knock Johnny and Sally's little teeth out if we don't appreciate everything that's on this report card. Legitimate concern number two, testing and grading sometimes tends to become the focus of the educational process. This is a major problem. Johnny says, is this information which has just been presented going to be on the test? And you say, Johnny, who cares if it's going to be on the test? This is knowledge. This is truth. This is marvelous material here. This should become a part of your life. You should passionately want to incorporate all of these little goodies into your lifestyle and to make all of these little things yours and to become possessor, the owner of all of this fascinating little information because it's going to make a better person out of you. To which Johnny's response is, Dad's not going to knock my teeth out if I become a better person. Dad's going to knock my teeth out if I don't get all B's or whatever. So in other words, instead of real growth and real learning and real knowledge becoming the end of the educational process, the report card becomes the end. And that's a very poor substitute for real growth. Now, hopefully, if we've done everything properly, the report card might be an indicator of real growth. But we just need to try to redirect the focus. We need to try to redirect it and say, at the end of the school year, look how much we've grown. And if the report card's a reflection of that growth, then fine and dandy. But let's make some knowledge. Let's make the acquisition of wisdom. Let's make godly action the goal our educational processes and not the silly little piece of paper with the letters on it. Legitimate concern number three. Testing and grading tends to discourage proper goal setting. And that obviously ties in with our last point. You can't set proper goals if everything toward which you are working is the test. The proper goal of learning should be what? It should be learning. And if we're not directing our goals toward learning, but we're directing our goals toward getting at least a 96 on the test, we've kind of shifted the focus of what the whole structure should be like. Legitimate concern number four, testing and grading sometimes tends to discourage the student, it encourages the student to study the teacher's techniques. A tricky student will very quickly learn, I don't have to listen here because this isn't something that Mrs. Smith is going to ask on the test. Or when reading in the textbook, the student will soon learn, the only thing I got to know in here is the words that are in bold print. Everything else I can ignore, so I'm not even going to bother to read the whole chapter. The only thing Mrs. Smith asks out of the textbook is the definition and terms that are in bold print, so I'm just going to memorize those terms and throw the rest of the textbook away. Or, Mrs. Smith only tests us on stuff that she writes on the board and emphasizes and stuff. So when she's just sitting there rambling, I'm going to tune her out. See, we've done this too, you know. The good student will very quickly learn what kind of things are going to be on the test. We all, as teachers, we all have our own little peculiarities in terms of the type of things that we emphasize and the type of things that we don't. And it's very easy for the intelligent and creative student to pick up very quickly what kinds of things are important to us and what are not, and therefore to study accordingly. So therefore the student misses 90% or ignores 90% of the material that we present because that's not the kind of stuff that they know that's not the kind of stuff that we're going to test them on. Legitimate concern number five, sometimes testing and grading can tend toward cramming. Cramming is an educational abomination. It causes the student to cram into their little minds an hour before the test or the night before a test or something like that, all of these little facts and figures and graphs and charts or whatever else that they're cramming into their poor little overworked minds. They review it just before the test. They get the test in front of them. They write out the test as quickly as they possibly can. In relief, they throw their paper and pencil down when it's over. They walk out of the room, and literally 10 minutes later, they haven't got a single fact of that left in their mind. They get the test back next week. They look at it, and they go, wow, I got an A on this thing. But they literally could not answer a single question at that point because everything that they crammed into their little minds has gone right out of it again. I have no problem with people reviewing before a test, but I have a problem with a form of testing which so easily facilitates cramming that an entire school year can go by and Johnny and Sally may not really have anything more in their heads than they did at the beginning of the year because everything was crammed the night before and forgotten 10 minutes after. A well-written test is going to be the sort of test which does not facilitate last-minute cramming of facts and figures, but which evaluates broad knowledge, profound interpretation of events, and so on. And that's something you can't cram for. That's something you can either you're either going to know as a result of long-term study or you're not going to know. Legitimate concern number six. Testing and grading rarely demonstrates areas of strength or weakness within a discipline, nor how to improve. Johnny, here's your computer-graded test, and you got a 76, which is a C-. Getting his computer-graded sheet back with all his little pencil marks in either box 1, 2, 3, or 4, telling Johnny that he's got a 76, which was a C-, and then moving on to the next unit, does Johnny absolutely no good. If that's the way we test and we grade, then Johnny and Sally have got a legitimate complaint. When we test, that should not be it. That should not be either reward or punishment in terms of what Johnny and Sally get on that particular test. That should be an indicator to both teacher and student what Johnny and Sally need to work on. Johnny got a 76. Okay, fine and dandy. What questions did he miss? Was there any consistency in the questions that he missed? If it was a math test, did he get all of his addition right and all of his subtraction right and all of his multiplication right? but he missed all his division. Is that an indicator that Johnny has to go back and that teacher and Johnny have to go back and review division? What does a 76 mean? Unless you know the areas of weakness. A test should not be a punishment. A test should be an indicator of areas in which Johnny and Sally are weak. And it should inform us how we can go back to those areas and seek to improve ourselves. Legitimate concern number 7. Teachers sometimes tend to test out of habit rather than with an intention. Teacher, why are you giving this test? Because it's been 3 weeks since I've given a test. No. That's not a good answer. You give a test every 3 weeks, fine and dandy, but why? Are you doing this so that you can discern what Johnny and Sally have learned over the past 3 weeks? What you've got to go back and review? What you've got to approach from a different angle? What you've got to do differently so that they can understand things that they presently don't understand? If that's the reason for giving a test, that's great. But if you're giving a test because you've gotten to the end of the unit, or because it's been every 3 weeks, or it's midterm, or it's finals, or something like that, without really knowing what place the test occupies in the educational process, teacher, that's illegitimate. That's wrong. We need to know why we're giving tests. And we need to emphasize to Johnny and Sally, this is not a punishment. This is so that I, your teacher, can learn how much of this material you've actually absorbed and assimilated. So that I, your teacher, can either move ahead or we can back up and we can review stuff. Because this knowledge is important for you folks. And I want you to learn it. I want you to be wise in this area. But the only way that I can do it is to truly evaluate whether you've really mastered it. Not just because it's the third week. Legitimate concern number 8. Tests can sometimes be irrelevant to the primary purposes of knowledge. We have a generation of young people, people in their early 20s, who can't hold down jobs. And basically what they're looking for is someone who will pay them to take tests all the time. Because they've gone through 12 or 16 years worth of school in which they haven't been challenged to think. They've been challenged to learn the words in italics and the words that are in bold print and memorize the stuff that teacher writes on the board and then regurgitate that on paper every third week. And they've gotten real good at that, but they haven't gotten to be very good at thinking. They haven't gotten to be very good at working competently. They haven't gotten to be very good at independent forethought, and so on. And so they graduate from college thinking that, aha, I have my college degree, now I am educated, now I'm going to get a good job. And they discover that the only thing that they're really capable of doing is going through textbooks and picking up and memorizing the words in bold print. And that's not a very good job skill. There's not a whole lot of businessmen that are going to pay you to do that. Businessmen want people that can think, that can act independently, that can be creative, that can better serve their businesses. And children, young people who have been taught for the past 16 years to think passively, if to think at all, don't really serve the needs of those business people. So the primary purposes of knowledge, of education, or the primary purposes of education should be the acquisition of knowledge, the attainment of the ability to think. And regrettably, testing does not oftentimes test that. And so sometimes we need to revise. Legitimate concern number 9. Testing and grading can sometimes tend to measure the student against his peers rather than his own progress and attainments. Boy, I sure hope nobody gets real good grade on this test. Because that'll mess up the curve. We've all heard that. We've probably all said it. Curves are bad things in the sense that they are comparing the students with each other. What difference does it make if Johnny gets a 90 or I get a 60 or something to that effect on a test, or if we all get 60s or whatever? The purpose of a test should be to measure my level of understanding, my level of insight in a given area against myself. It's not too terribly relevant where I am as far as Johnny's concerned. The thing that's relevant to me is how much did I know about this subject 3 weeks ago, or whenever the last test was, and how much have I grown in my knowledge of this subject? I should be graded against myself, not against the rest of the class. To think that everybody that's 8 years old ought to have the same level of mathematical competence is as bizarre as saying that everybody that's my age, I happen to be the same age as Julius Erving, the basketball player, like saying that Julius Erving and I should be able to play basketball at the exact same level because we're the same age. That's a ridiculous concept. Nobody's offered me $2 million a year to play basketball recently. So why would we expect all 8-year-olds to have the same mathematical abilities, the same linguistical abilities, the same grammatical abilities, etc.? It's not relevant what Johnny's doing in comparison to Billy. It's relevant to what was relevant is what's Johnny doing now compared to what Johnny was doing yesterday, or 3 weeks ago, or a month ago, or a year ago, or whatever. Okay, so then we've got 7 guidelines for appropriate evaluation and reporting. I'm not against testing and grading. I'm against erroneous testing and grading. I'm against ludicrous testing and grading. I'm against sloppily done testing and grading. Point number 1, evaluation should be rigorous and relevant. If we're going to give a test, it ought to scrutinize Johnny and Sally's knowledge and abilities and insight and wisdom. Because that's what the purpose of education is all about. Knowledge, abilities, insights, wisdom. Not simply their ability to memorize pointless facts. The development of memory is important, and we should stress that. But not to the exclusion of the ability to think. Memorizing facts doesn't do you any good if you don't know how to think with those facts. And so for most grade levels and so on, tests and grades should be more concerned with scrutinization, discernment, analysis, and so on. Guideline number 2, it should be continually emphasized that the goal of learning is godly learning, not grading. I don't know how we can avoid this because our society places so much emphasis upon the stupid report card, but we should constantly emphasize to Johnny and Sally and Mom and Dad. Doesn't do a whole lot of good to give Johnny and Sally this little lecture if Mom and Dad are still of the old school and place the high priority upon the report card. That the goal of learning is godly knowledge, not the report card, not the grade. If Johnny gets a B in a subject, and he's legitimately done his best, he's legitimately done all that he can before the face of God to master that particular subject, but he just can't get much higher than a 90% or so on any kind of legitimate analysis that's taken of his competency, then that B is the best he can do. I used to be a math teacher, and I've come to the conclusion that some children simply have a God-given mathematical insight. We can all learn, but some children seem to have minds which function in mathematical categories, and some children, bless their hearts, simply don't, and it breaks my heart because I taught the slower groups and so on, and there were some kids who tried so hard for so many hours a day to learn some relatively simple mathematical concepts. It wasn't a question of effort. I've simply come to the conclusion that it was primarily an issue of minds which function perhaps grammatically in grammatical categories, but not in the mathematical categories, or vice versa, or whatever. And it just broke my heart to see a lot of these kids try so hard. And I'd try everything that I could think of to get it across to them. I went to the more experienced math teachers and asked their counsel and so on. And there was just some of the children, bless their hearts, that just couldn't seem to apprehend some of the material. But their effort, their intensity, etc., was just so marvelous. And it just seemed to be an incongruity to give them a relatively low grade after the effort. And after the improvement, maybe they still weren't doing great in terms of the rest of the class, but maybe there's this profound improvement over the course of the year or whatever. So we should continually stress that the goal is to attain knowledge, to attain wisdom, to attain insight, not necessarily just to get an A or a B on the report card. Guideline number 3, the student should be evaluated in terms of his own progress, not in terms of the class, in terms of where Johnny or Sally is at the beginning of the school year, in terms of where Johnny and Sally wind up at the end of the school year. A student that's very gifted mathematically, for example, could really only grow very, very slightly over a school year in mathematical knowledge and still do very well at the third grade level. The third grader who's extremely smart in mathematics could kind of just bounce along the entire school year doing perhaps better than all of his or her classmates, but not really put any effort forth because there's no real challenge in the setting of the classroom. Whereas maybe a person at the other end of the spectrum who's got a great deal of difficulty with mathematics could just try his or her heart out and still not do real good in terms of the rest of the class, but could maybe grow in mathematical knowledge 50%. Well, how do you reward someone who's doubled their knowledge of mathematics, as opposed to someone who's maybe only picked up a few new things the entire school year, but the person who's grown is still so radically far behind the person who has only grown a little bit but was that much farther to begin with? I don't have a good answer to that. I really don't, but I do think that students should be evaluated in terms of their own progress, and somebody who grows 50% in their knowledge of that subject, maybe they didn't start off real far along, but someone who's grown 50% in their knowledge of the subject should not be overly penalized, in my humble opinion. Guideline number 4, there should be consideration of the intellectual and maturational level of a student. Don't ask for philosophical analysis from a 5-year-old, but ask for more than memorization of a list of dates and names from a college student. When we're dealing with the younger students, we can't ask for profound essays. But when we're dealing with college students or advanced high school students, we should ask for more than fill in the blanks. So we need to recognize lists of spelling words are important for third graders and so on. We should not be having to give spelling lists to high school students. If a student doesn't know how to use a dictionary and we're continually getting papers with misspelled words, we need to teach them how to use a dictionary and expect papers to be turned in with appropriately spelled words and so on. The more mature a student gets intellectually, the more we should be asking analysis, criticism, insight, rather than just the regurgitation of facts and figures. The facts and figures are important. You don't ignore them. But you learn the facts and figures for the purposes of analysis and for thought and so on. Guideline number 5, the teacher and the student should know the purpose of the evaluation and what part it plays in the overall educational process. Teacher and student should know why there's going to be a test on Friday, what part it plays in the overall educational process. Guideline number 6, there should be informal times of evaluation in which students can learn from their mistakes and even do self-evaluation. The School of Hard Knocks is a very good school. We learn a lot there, and we learn from the School of Hard Knocks to a great degree in the sense that we can correct our mistakes. My little daughter is just learning to walk right now, and bless her heart, it's a good thing she's got a good diaper on because she falls a lot, but that's how you learn to walk. You learn to walk by falling and taking a few more steps each time. Sometimes our forms of testing and grading more or less are not good indicators of God's grace, because if you blow it, buddy, you're dead. There's no chance for you now. I'm not necessarily saying the student should continually have the opportunity to take over every test, but I am saying that testing should be relatively non-intimidating in the sense that the student should be free to make a mistake. You shouldn't have this dread that, oh my goodness, I don't know this, my life has come to an end. Well, the test, that's what the test should be for. It should reveal to you that, hey, you don't know this. So don't worry about it. Go back and learn it. But so often tests are, you don't know this, this becomes a permanent part of your record, and it's going to haunt you for the rest of your life. You're never going to get a good job when you grow up because you failed this third grade geography test. That's not the way things should be. Sometimes we should test or evaluate the student simply for the sake of learning where they are, and simply for the sake of showing to them where their mistakes are and how they can go back and improve their mistakes. A major part of life is learning how to correct our mistakes. That's a skill that we have to learn, but regrettably, a lot of forms of testing and grading don't allow that. So there should be these quote-unquote informal times of testing in which, Johnny, don't sweat this. This is not going to follow you around the rest of your life. This is not going to prevent you from landing a job when you grow up. Let's just see how much you know about this, and what you don't know, let's go back and learn it. The mistakes that you make, let's correct them. That's what life's like. When we make a mistake in life, sometimes it's a mistake that will haunt us for the rest of our lives, but most of the mistakes we make are correctable, and Johnny and Sally simply need to learn how to do that. Guideline number 7, the reporting of progress should be as descriptive as possible, including specific things learned and areas which still need improvement. Johnny, this is the end of the year. You got a B in history. What in the world does that mean? That doesn't tell Mom and Dad what Johnny knows about history and what he doesn't know about history. Teachers might rebel against this, but I think report cards should be descriptive rather than simply letters. In mathematics, Johnny has learned this principle, and this principle. he's still weak in this principle and this principle. In history, Johnny's learned this, that, and the other sort of thing. He has not learned whatever. That may be more work for the teacher, but I think it's a more relevant methodology of reporting things so that mom and dad can really and truly know what Johnny and Sally have accomplished, what they've learned, what they haven't learned during the school year. And that's supposedly what testing and grading should be all about.